Welcome to Shouts from the Back Row, the official podcast of the-back-row.com. My name is Gil, and I'm your host, and with me as always are my co-hosts Robin.
Hello.
And TK.
Hello.
On recent podcast episodes, we have discussed the latest William Friedkin film, Killer Joe, and with the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences nominating both Beasts of the Southern Wild and Les Miserables in the Best Picture category, I'd say it's high time we take a look at stage play to film adaptations. Now, adaptations are tricky business, but generally speaking, live theater is probably the closest medium to a movie without actually being a movie. So we're going to dissect the idea of bringing live theater to the movie screen, talk about our favorite and least favorite play-to-film adaptations, and also talk a little bit about the inverse effect where a movie gets turned into a live play. But first, some announcements. The Back Row has a PayPal account, and we're accepting donations. If you feel like throwing some of your hard-earned dollars our way, you can do so at The Back Row. Just go to the-back-row.com and click the Donate button in the right column. If you donate, you can choose a movie for us to review and even specify which of us gets to review it. Doesn't that sound like fun? So send us a quarter and request your favorite stage play to screenplay adaptation. Shouts from the Back Row is available through iTunes. If you search the iTunes store for the Back Row podcasts, you can subscribe to our feed, which will not only get you your weekly dose of media culture from us, but also Tom Lando's all-original audiobook podcast series, Oathbreakers, and back episodes of our heavy metal podcast, Drop D Revolution, and our surreality podcast, The Tom Lando Files. Tell your friends and subscribe today. We like to open the show with a discussion of what we've been up to. This is a place for us to talk about movies we've been watching, TV shows we've been following, games we've been playing, and just about everything else we've been doing. So, TK, what have you been up to?
Other than still working my way through Crusader Kings 2, my dynasty is still controlling Sweden with an iron fist, which is wonderful. I actually haven't been up to very much. I did see Lincoln last night. I really enjoyed Lincoln. The acting was outstanding. And all these people kept popping up in it. It was really weird. I was watching with one of my friends, and she had her computer with her and IMDb open, and I kept going, is that Michael Stuhlbarg? Is that, oh my God, no, I just forgot his name. That's awful. I was right on the tip of my tongue yesterday. There's a whole bunch of like weird of little bit actors in it. The guy that played the gentleman that plays, Gus in the second or third season of Breaking Bad.
Oh, Giancarlo Esposito.
Yeah, he's in it. Oh my God. In Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, it's George Clooney and John Turturro and
Tim Blake Nelson.
Tim Blake Nelson's in it too. There's just a whole bunch of people in this movie that I wasn't really expecting. It was kind of cool. James Spader's in it. It was really, really, really well acted, guys. Like, this is, if you want to see anything that's worth the acting nod this year, this movie is it, because it's got everything. Sally Field is really good. Daniel Day-Lewis was, I have no words for how well good Daniel Day-Lewis was.
Do you think he's going to take home the Oscar?
I don't know. That's the thing, is that it's, I kind of, well, what's his competition for best actor? It's Hugh Jackman and Denzel Washington and Joaquin Phoenix and missing one.
I will check. But yeah. Do finish your thought.
I don't know, because I don't think Lincoln's going to win Best Picture. I don't think Spielberg's going to get Best Director for it. Because like the film would draw me in and then bore me, and then draw me in and then bore me, then draw me in and bore me. It was like a wave that kept happening.
The fifth nominee is Bradley Cooper for Silver Linings Playbook.
When I watch more of those films, I think I'll have a better idea on who's gonna grab it, but. Because I don't think, like, Lincoln was a good movie, but it's not a great movie. The acting is great, but the film itself, I don't feel is as interesting. Like, the concept is interesting, like, the period is interesting, but I find that Spielberg tells a very up-and-down story with it. But it's so worth seeing, guys, just for the acting. It's just incredible. Overall, I'd probably give it a 4 out of 5 if I had to grade it. But like I said, I think the plot is its really only shortcoming. And one of my friends, my friend who I was watching with, turned to me about halfway through, and she says, I don't know how this is gonna end. But
gee, I wonder.
Yeah, I don't know how it's gonna end. And actually, because they do cover the assassination, and the way they did it, I felt was really bad. So that kind of downs it in my eyes as well. But all in all, it's a strong movie, and I would recommend seeing it.
Well, I do need to see it to see all the nominees for Best Picture, but have not yet. Robin, have you seen Lincoln?
Yes, I gave my thoughts on it a couple months ago, and I agree with TK. Like, this is a movie that could potentially be very boring and dry if the acting just wasn't so good, because a lot of it is, like, a lot of people sitting around in rooms and courtrooms and talking. But, like, he pretty much touched upon one of my favorite things about the film, is that it's a character actor nirvana, where, like, every scene you'll see a recognizable character actor pop up, and they may not have a big role, but they do make an impression. I still remember when I saw it, I'd completely forgotten that Joseph Gordon-Levitt was in the film and was pleasantly surprised when he popped up. But I'm actually calling this one to probably win Best Picture, because I know I originally predicted Argo, but I realized that Ben Affleck is not nominated for Best Director, and I noticed that Spielberg is, and looking at the other Best Director nominations, I feel Lincoln is the kind of film that the Academy just eats up, and though I don't think it's the best film of the year, I think it's probably going to win Best Picture, and I still think Daniel Day Lewis is going to be a shoo-in, pretty much, even though he's won before, because he pops up every few years when he feels like winning an Oscar, and he totally inhabits this role, and he deserves it. But yeah, this is definitely, it's a good film that is greatly enhanced by the quality of the acting.
Yeah, that's that pretty much sums up my thoughts about it. Shit, I had something else. I had something else I really wanted to say about it. Now I can't remember what it is. Michael Stuhlbarg's in it, and like I didn't recognize him at first. It took like a couple of glances. I'm like, that's Michael Stuhlbarg. Yeah, that's Michael Stuhlbarg. And the friend I was watching it with, when Tommy Lee Jones comes on the screen, she's like, "Oh, I didn't know he was in this." And I'm like, "He's nominated for Best Supporting Actor in this. How do you not know he was in it?"
And he's become a recent meme with that great picture of him all grumpy at the Golden Globes, making the rounds. Have you seen that yet?
Yeah, it's priceless.
Just as a side note, something I forgot to mention, I think it was last week when I was talking about the movie Seven Psychopaths, Michael Stuhlbarg is also in that. So,
no way, really?
Yep, yet another reason to watch it.
And yet another reason. Other than that, the only thing I've been doing recently is I've been reading Grant Morrison's Super Gods, which the tagline is what mass vigilantes, miraculous mutants, and a sun god from Smallville can teach us about being human. This book is fascinating if you have any interest in any type of any comic. It's outstanding. I just got through a chapter where he spends an awful lot of time talking about Watchmen and its impact on the comic society. And, like, I like comic books, but I'm not huge into them. So it's kind of neat just hearing names that, like, I kind of know about float around. And the way Morrison talks about them is super interesting. And just comics' effect on pop culture is brilliant. And he feels that there's a deeper tie into the human psyche with it. The book is really interesting if you're A, a Grant Morrison fan, B, a comic book fan. And it's well worth a read. And I also, at the urging, not the urging, but when Morrison was talking about it, DC rebooted their whole DC universe last year. And I started grabbing a couple of the comics, and I actually, a couple of graphic novels. I grabbed the Superman reboot, and I grabbed the Aquaman reboot, and then I grabbed the Justice League reboot when they all meet each other. The Aquaman one is really good. And I'm really impressed with it. Like, they really make him into a really interesting character with his flaws and super and cool powers and stuff. And, you know, Aquaman's kind of growing on me. I'll say it. There we go. As opposed to all the hilarious jokes made about him over the past couple of years. But it's well worth it. The New 52 stuff is well worth a read, I feel. And at the urging of Morrison, I'm going to read a lot more of it, I think.
I haven't read all the different like series that were released with the DC New 52, but I have been reading the Scott Snyder run of Batman and like Batman related comics like Nightwing and Batgirl. It's in a series called Death of the Family, and it's basically the Joker coming after each of these different people associated with Batman in this really horrible way. And if you like Batman and you're getting into the New 52, then you really should read Death of the Family. It's a really good series.
And other than that, gentlemen, that's pretty much all I've been up to. How about you guys?
Robin, what have you been up to?
Well, I saw a film which it's not necessarily on my most anticipated films of 2003, but I was still looking forward to it regardless, and that's Arnold Schwarzenegger's The Last Stand. I wasn't expecting a whole lot about this, but I really wanted to see it because it was Arnold's first leading role in quite some time, and it was also the Hollywood debut of Kim Ji-woon, the Korean director of stuff like The Good, the Bad, the Weird, and I Saw the Devil. And this is a very weird project for him to make his Hollywood debut on, but it made me curious. And I must say, without those two guys on it, without Arnold and Kim Ji-woon, this would probably be a straight-to-DVD movie. Like, it's pretty basic, generic stuff. Like, it feels like it was a script that was taken out of the drawer. It was originally written in the 80s and then taken out of a drawer, and then they just decided to make it into a movie. But I will say it is pretty fun, undemanding entertainment. Like, the first two-thirds of it are about as by-the-numbers and generic as you can get, because it's got wooden dialogue, wooden characters. But it feels like when the movie gets to the last act, to the big shootout climax in the town, it's kind of like they just turned Kim Ji-woon loose and let him do whatever the hell he wanted, because there's some hilarious action scenes in this. Like, the violence is really gory and over the top, and he pretty much, even though the first two-thirds of it are rather serious and straightforward, he kind of plays, like, the last part of the film for laughs and has some really funny moments in it. There are a couple actors in here who play it, like, really broadly, like Peter Stormare is a villain, and he's really over the top, and Louis Guzman plays the bumbling deputy, and he plays it really broad, and Johnny Knoxville's character kind of feels like he's wandered in from a different movie. Like, he barely does anything at all in the first two-thirds of the film, and then he just kind of shows up in the climax and is shooting people with flare guns and makes them explode, but it's entertaining. And there's also a very weird cameo from Harry Dean Stanton, and it's become kind of a meme almost, because I know he was in Seven Psychopaths, and he also had that cameo in the Avengers. So he likes to just kind of pop up in movies now for these one-scene cameos, and his one in this is quite funny and unexpected, too. So anyway, the shootout climax is really fun, and it has quite a cool fight scene at the end between Arnold Schwarzenegger and the villain having a mano-on-mano fight on a bridge that's really over-the-top and done tongue-in-cheek. So overall, I would probably give this one a 3 out of 5. If you're an Arnold Schwarzenegger fan, definitely go check it out. And it's just a good way to kill an evening. Like, it won't set the world on fire or anything. Unfortunately, I noticed it kind of flopped at the box office this weekend, so it doesn't say much for Arnold Schwarzenegger's as a box office draw anymore, unfortunately. But I'm anxious. I hear he's going to make a new Terminator movie, actually, so I'm anxious to see that. And I'm anxious to see what Kim Ji-woon does next, because this was a pretty routine film, but he did show flashes of his talent, so I'm anxious to see what kind of Hollywood film he does next. So, yeah, overall, I give The Last Stand a mild thumbs up, but I wouldn't go out of your way to see it.
I am curious a little about The Last Stand, just because it looks like a sort of a goofy action movie, and it appealed to my sensibilities with a very sort of 80s-inspired poster. But I'm really curious to see how they'll explain the Terminator being an old guy in
Exactly.
Terminator 5.
Yeah, it's kind of like, why would you construct him? Because I got to give it, I mean, Arnold looks great for a guy in his 60s, but you can still see, like, the wrinkles on his face. So I really can't see him being a convincing-looking Terminator unless they do some major CGI on his face. And as far as what else I've been seeing, I finally saw the documentary West of Memphis, which is another documentary produced about the infamous West Memphis 3 case. I've talked about it quite at length on these podcasts before, about the Paradise Lost documentaries, the trilogy that was produced. And this, I kind of was curious about this one because they've already done 3 documentaries about this case, and I wondered, like, why were they going to release another one? But this one I thought was interesting because it was funded by Peter Jackson, who has been, like, a big, like, outspoken person on this case. He's contributed to, like, the defense fund, and he's tried to, like, lobby for the release and stuff. So, and this is still, like, a very good documentary. Like, it covered a lot of stuff that I'd already known before, but I like the angle that it took, that it was more of a personal story, whereas the Paradise Lost trilogy kind of goes over the details of the case. And watching this, they go over the case a bit, but they kind of assume that you already know a lot of the details about it, but they get to know, like, the people involved more. Like, one of the most interesting things is Damien Eccles, who was
like the wrongly convicted ringleader on the group who went to death row. He actually like got involved in a relationship with this woman named Lori Davis, and they actually got married after sending all these letters back and forth, even though he was still on death row, and she's been the big one to try to get them released from prison. And now it's quite interesting to see them at the end finally get to be a couple after he's been in prison all this time. The creepiest elements of the film is when they look at Terry Hobbs, the stepfather of the three children who were murdered. He's one of the victims. They go into more detail in the Paradise Lost documentaries about like what a creep he is and why he's probably the real murderer and walking around free. The stuff involving him is some of the most disturbing stuff I've ever seen in a documentary, because he's basically got this smug look that he's gotten away with it and the police will never try to catch him because they don't want to admit that they made a mistake. So that's really powerful stuff. So yes, I would say this is, even if you've already seen the Paradise Lost documentaries, I'd say this is a really good capper to watch. And even if you're not familiar with the case at all, this would be a good documentary to start with, because it goes over the facts of the case and puts a more human thing on the events. And a lot of great interviews as well with Peter Jackson in it, in the documentary too. He's really impassioned about this case. And as a side note, one movie I forgot to mention on my most anticipated movies of 2013 is The Devil's Knot, which is a fictionalized version of the case that's going to be directed by Adam McGoyan. And it's got a really interesting cast, too. It's got Reese Witherspoon and Bruce Greenwood and Colin Firth and Kevin Durant. So I forgot to mention it on that Lost podcast, but I'm really looking forward to it as well in 2013.
Excellent. I have not seen either of those documentaries. Well, I guess the one hasn't come out yet. But yeah, I am curious, because this got an Oscar nomination for the best documentary category, so I'll have to look into it.
Yeah, it's like not many stories could like span across four entire documentaries, but this one has, so it's well worth checking out. And yeah, that's about all I've been up to.
As for what I've been up to, I haven't been up to much. And one of the things that I did do is I watched Les Miserables, and I think I'm going to save my thoughts on it for our discussion of movie-to-play adaptations, because most of my criticisms of it have to do with that. But overall, I got to say, I wasn't all that impressed. But as I said, I'll get into that more in our main discussion. Other than that, really the only new thing I've done is I played Act 1, which is the first episode of this video game called Kentucky Route Zero, which will be available shortly on Steam, and right now you can buy it off of the official Kentucky Route Zero website. And this is a particular kind of point-and-click video game. It reminds me an awful lot of Super Brothers Sword and Sorcery, which was released on PC and also on like the iPod and the iPad. Both Kentucky Route Zero and Super Brothers are these sort of very avant-garde artsy stories, often dealing with weird supernatural elements, and where all the characters talk in a very sort of unusual vernacular. And both games also have these really distinctive, interesting art styles. By the time you listen to this this podcast, I will have posted the trailer for Kentucky Route Zero Episode 1. It's really interesting. You're an antiques delivery man, and you're lost in this sort of odd area of Kentucky that seems very isolated from the rest of the world. And you keep meeting these very weird people who I think are ghosts. I think they're ghosts. But, of course, only Act 1 of this game is available so far, so I don't even have that much of the story in context yet. Much like the Walking Dead video game from Telltale Games, this is one of these video games where they're releasing it episodically, so I'm going to have to keep returning the more they release episodes. And now that I think about it, I find that format almost a little annoying. I don't like cliffhangers in my video games, these forced cliffhangers. I want to be able to play all the way through if I want. And thus far, I'd say if I had the option, Kentucky Route Zero is one that I would have played just all the way through, probably in one sitting, because it's just so creative. The sound design is really good. The art style is really cool. And I don't know, it's very unusual and very sort of quiet and atmospheric for a video game, but it's also just sort of a sight to behold. It's really cool. This is another video game that you can file under the video games as art category that Roger Ebert wants to deny ever existed. And that's really all I've been up to. So now let's talk a bit about movies based on plays. And we already covered some of this when we talked about movie musicals, because quite often movie musicals are based on plays. Not exclusively. There's certain musicals that were made just for the movies. But we did cover part of this. And as a result, I tried to leave musicals, for the most part, off of my list. But before we get to our lists, I mean, did you guys have any additional restrictions like that one that you imposed upon yourself? And do you just have any thoughts on the idea of adapting a play into a movie?
I didn't really have any restrictions, no. All I asked is that they had been performed on stage of some sort before they were made into a movie. And sometimes, surprisingly, like I was looking at the list of plays, and there really aren't that many, or films based on plays, aren't that many that I don't like. So, and it seems that they don't really want to try this unless they're sure it'll work out, because I know it's a totally different medium, and that because you're pretty much all in one location on stage, it's tough to adapt to film. But I found that most films have actually done it pretty well, so I can think of many more examples where it worked well than when it didn't.
Yeah, there are a real number of classics on the somewhat short list of movies that have been adapted from plays. But yeah, it seems like overall many of these films are just awesome. They're really, really good. And like I said, viewed by many as classics. TK, did you have any restrictions that you put on yourself when you were choosing your favorites, or any thoughts on the nature of the stage to movie adaptation?
I always thought that stage adapted really well to films, but it all depends on who's either directing or whether or not the story is good enough to hold together. I didn't restrict myself to anything, so like when I was going, my honorable mentions list actually has a bunch of musicals on it, which I feel is fine. But actually, I don't think I have any. I don't think I have any in my number three. No, it doesn't look like I do. So that's awesome. No, I lied. I have one.
I have one musical in my top three.
Yeah. So, no, I find that stage adapts very well to film, and that actually gives them a bit of range as well. Like, you can go to outside locations, you can add CGI, but stuff that you can't really exactly pull off on stage. So I think it gives them a bit more flexibility when it comes to fleshing out their story and the characters. So I think it's a neat little adaptation. It's kind of fun to do from there. So that's my thoughts.
One thing that I definitely restricted myself when making my list was I decided no Shakespeare. Too easy. Shakespeare,
yeah.
It's just too easy. I mean, I could have done a top three that was all Kenneth Branagh movies, just because he's done some really good Shakespeare adaptations. And Shakespeare's like, it's the Bard. Like, so much is just he's this, like, gold standard. You know, so much is compared to the works of William Shakespeare that it's kind of unfair to add him into the mix, if you will. So I was also thinking, I too remarked that there are a lot of really successful play-to-movie adaptations, to the point where some movies based off of plays were so well done that they become better known as, like, the prime version of that story. And I'll give more examples. I don't want to spoil anybody's picks. But I'll give more examples as we go on. But there are some movies based on plays that have become sort of the iconic version of that script. And I found that really interesting.
That's true. It's like I remember looking through the list and I was like, oh my God, I totally forgotten this movie was based on a play, just because like the movie has surpassed the play version so much.
There were a couple surprises when I was looking through. I'm like, I didn't know that was based off a play. So.
Yeah, exactly. It's pretty remarkable. But there are some cases that, boy, it didn't work for me. And as I said, Les Miserables is actually one. But let's talk about our favorites, and then we can talk about the rest. TK, what is your number three pick for the best movies based on plays?
My number three is my musical, and it's Little Shop of Horrors, the one with Rick Moranis and Steve Martin. I've seen Little Shop of Horrors three. I've seen, I've seen the old 50s version in black and white. I've seen the updated one that was, and the two films I've seen, and I've also seen it performed on stage. And all three have their good and bad aspects, but. The Rick Moranis Little Shop of Horrors takes the stage play and just pulls you right into the scene and locale and just gets you right into the characters and obviously the special effects, especially at the end of the film, I find are way better than anything you'll see on the play, and really bring the film to life for me. And like, when you watch it on stage, you're very aware to a point, but when you're watching a movie, like, you're sucked right in. You're like, you're there on Skid Row with the characters because they give them so much. They give everyone the depth they need in such much more time. I always really like this. Whenever I think of a Rick Moranis role, I actually always think of Little Shop as opposed to anything else. But it's a great movie, guys. It made a great adaptation, and I think the film version is much stronger than anything you'll see on a live stage these days. It's kind of become sort of timeless in its own little way, and all the little cameos, like the Bill Murray cameos, the patient, and that sort of thing. You can't get that sort of stuff on stage, and I thought it was you can, but not to the same effect. But I like this adaptation, guys. What are your thoughts on Little Shops?
the play of Little and the movie of Little Shop of Horrors, it lives or dies based on how well done the Audrey 2 plant is. And in the Frank Oz directed one, it is awesome. The giant puppet they have as the Audrey 2 Venus flytrap is so well done that it sells the whole movie for me. Like, they have that thing singing, and like, they have its vines moving around and like tapping like fingers. It must have taken like a dozen people just to control that whole puppet. But boy, does it ever work. It works absolutely fantastically. The songs of Little Shop of Horrors are also really catchy. There's some really good ones. The opening Skid Row number, and in particular, I really do love the dentist song. Like, now I'm a dentist, especially the rendition that Steve Martin does. This is an opportunity for him to do his really like over the top ham bone style and still pull it off. He does it really well. This was probably my favorite musical when I was a kid. It's been a few years since I've watched it, but I mean, there are so many things I like about it. I love the B-movie story. Frank Oz is great. Puppets are great. There are just so many awesome things about it I think it's a really good one. A good pick.
Little Shop of Horrors. Yeah, this is such an interesting case because this is a movie that went from film to stage back to film again. Like, it started off as a low-budget film by Roger Corman way back in the 1960s and was able to build up a big enough cult following that it was made into a stage musical, and then it wound up being made into a film again, which was a musical. And with each adaptation, it just got more and more popular. And I like the original version with Roger Corman. It's very low-budget, of course, but it is pretty fun. But obviously, he had a lot of limitations about what he could do, because like, the plant obviously like looks really, really cheap in the original because of the low budget. But of course, in the Little Shop of Horrors remake, it looks like so much better. It looks spectacular. And like, I'm sure if this film was made today, it would be done like with CGI and stuff, the plant. But back then, when it was done practical, they made it look terrific. And it's really the key to the film. And the musical version is just a lot of fun. I particularly love the casting of Bill Murray as the masochistic dental patient. It was a cool use of a cameo because in the original film, Jack Nicholson played the dental patient, and it was one of his very early roles back when he was in Roger Corman films. So it's quite fun to look back in that. I almost kind of wish they had given him a cameo of some sort in the musical version, but I guess they couldn't. But it still holds up really well. And it's quite amazing how this little Roger Corman film that he shot in like 2 days could build up such a cult following that it could spiral into a very popular musical.
Yeah, you know, I really do need to revisit this one. Like I said, it was one of my favorites when I was young, but I don't know how well it'll hold up upon review. I remember even as a kid finding Ellen Green, who plays Audrey, really quite annoying with her singing. But I mean, that's just me. Maybe I've grown more tolerant of it. Still, it's all worth it for the plant puppet and for Rick Moranis as the dentist. Robin, what's your number three?
Actually, that's a funny transition because my number three actually features Ellen Green as well in a very annoying supporting role. So that's a funny coincidence. But my number three is Talk Radio by Oliver Stone, which I've written a Robin's Underrated Gems column on sometime last year. And I think it's definitely Oliver Stone's most underrated film. And it's really not like your typical like Oliver Stone film because it's minimalist. It's claustrophobic and takes place in nearly all in one location. But it works really, really well. Basically, it was based on a Pulitzer Prize stage play written by Eric Bogosian, who plays the lead role of Barry Champlain, this very controversial DJ that hosts like a late night radio show. And it's basically his whole shtick is saying really controversial, offensive things and getting arguments with his callers and stuff. And it was loosely based on like a real life incident where like this Denver DJ got so controversial that one of his listeners actually showed up at the station and shot him. And watching this film, it's just amazing how way ahead of its time it was, because it was made in like 1988 when the concept of like shock jocks and stuff was really not common at all. Like this was kind of a fresh trend that the bombastic personality who appeared on radio and TV for the sole purpose of like offending people and generating ratings. And Bogosian is like terrific in this role because he's playing a guy who's not particularly like a likable character, but he's still very fascinating. And I think it is because his character is just so self-loathing, because he's become like really, really successful in his field and is generating all these ratings, but he's starting to hate the fact that like he has gotten successful just by being offensive and being a guy that people hate. And he almost kind of senses that his character has a death wish and that he wants one of his crazy fans to like eventually come in and kill them. The majority of this film takes place in like a claustrophobic like radio studio, which you'd think would be death for like a film, but it works really well here. And there's some like really tense scenes, like where Barry receives like a package from a listener that he thinks might have a bomb in it, and he slowly tries opening it up as he's on the air. And there's a great running gag where this like stoned character is like telling him off over the radio, and finally Barry invites him to come visit him at the studio even though he might be dangerous. It's a terrific supporting role by the character actor Michael Wincott as this like major stoner who's on the radio and is just like batshit insane and crazy. And it's kind of funny just seeing Barry's interactions with these callers, because you see how these insane nut jobs operated before the internet, where their only venue was to call this like talk show and like spread their like racist controversial views and stuff. And that's why this is just so ahead of its time. And it builds up to a terrific final monologue where like Barry finally tells off his viewers and says what bullshit his existence is, and everybody thinks he's brilliant and stuff. So this film isn't very well known. It's one of Oliver Stone's lesser known films, but it holds up really well. Like the last time I watched it, I was just amazed at how prescient it seemed, because there are just so many people like the character of Barry Champlain on radio and TV right now. And and even though this doesn't seem like the kind of thing that would work on it's a stage play that would work on film, it works remarkably well.
I have not seen this movie, and it sounds like I really should.
Yes.
TK, have you seen this?
No, sorry, Robin, I haven't, so wish I could respond.
Yeah, gosh. I'm kind of embarrassed to be at a loss to add my comments, but it certainly sounds really good, and I really like Michael Wincott, so any role that gives him an opportunity to be his unique, creepy self is a good one in my books.
Oh, definitely. Oh, and I should also mention that they revived this for Broadway a couple years ago, the stage play, and they cast Liev Schreiber in the role of Barry Champlain. So I'd really like to see that. I'm sure he would be terrific in the role.
So my number three, this is actually a film that you put me on to, Robin. 1967 film Wait Until Dark, directed by Terrence Young.
Yes.
This is a great movie. Audrey Hepburn plays a woman who was recently blinded in an accident, and three thugs are trying to search her apartment for a doll that they think is stuffed with drugs. And they're trying to dupe her by attempting to take advantage of the fact that she's blind. They put on different voices and things like that. But and it's just her all alone, sort of newly blinded, and so she still hasn't gotten used to having one of her senses be disabled. And it's really fascinating how over the course of this film you get to watch her adapt and you get to watch her start to sort of gain control of her surroundings a bit. And she starts noticing things like, you know, it seemed like there were two people in here, like two different people, but they were both wearing the same shoes. They both had the same squeaky shoes on. And just using her other senses, she is able to undo this plot that's being perpetrated by a young Alan Arkin, of all people. It's really fantastic. This is the kind of film based on a play where you can sort of see how it was based on a play, just because it takes place, I'd say a good 99% in the same location of her apartment. Maybe we get one or two moments outside, but the action is all just rooted with her, and there's a reason that she can't leave her apartment, and this mystery unfolds all around her, and it builds into this really terrific climax that's sort of gone down, become iconic in cinema, where she is alone in the apartment, and Alan Arkin's thug character he's just going to kill her. He's decided he's going to kill her, and she turns the tables on him by turning out the lights so he can't see, but she can. And this is, spoiler alert for the end of Wait Until Dark, but this is one of those great moments where you think the killer's dead, and then out of nowhere, he just jumps into frame, still alive and still out for blood. I think it's a really fantastic, tight little film, and I think it would probably be just as effective on stage, but of course, Audrey Hepburn is a great actress. She delivers a really good performance here. Alan Arkin is excellent. Richard Crenna is kind of funny as her vaguely milquetoast husband. But yeah, overall, this is a terrific movie, and especially for that final act, the climactic sequence where she turns out the lights and you think the killer's dead, but he's not. It's really, really well done. And as I said, Robin, you put me onto this movie. I had never heard of it before, and I totally love it. This is a good one that I like to recommend to people.
It's actually my number two as well.
Hey, excellent.
Yeah, it's definitely one of my all-time favorites. Like you said, like it starts off as like an obvious stage play because it is kind of slow at first, because it's like, I know the first half hour show is just a bunch of people like talking together in a room, kind of setting up the plot, but it does such a marvelous job at like building up tension. And like you said, like the climax, I'm amazed to just how well it holds up like over 45 years later. Like the whole cliche there of like the killer you think is dead and then suddenly jumps out at you. Like I think that had rarely ever been done before, and apparently when people saw this in theaters way back in the 60s, they were just screaming because it was just so new. But yeah, it's really, really tense stuff, and it's very well acted by Audrey Hepburn and Alan Arkin, and it's pretty much still, like I'd say, it's like something for filmmakers to watch on, a great way to build up tension where you just start up slowly and then tighten it up until it just pretty much becomes almost unbearable at the end with how tense it is. And one other thing I want to mention about it is apparently they did a Broadway stage version of this in the 90s where Quentin Tarantino played Harry Rote Jr. And I would love to track down some footage of that, because that sounds really interesting.
Yeah, no kidding. I would love to see that. Yeah, just the tension is very palpable. I've read an interview with Stephen King where he cites it as like one of the most amazing tense sequences he's ever seen in a film. And frankly, I think he's right. I think it's just so well done, so tightly done. And this is sort of like the best case scenario, one of the best case scenarios for me when you see a play like this adapted for the big screen, where like it's well cast, it's really well acted, they have the right person in the main role. This is the kind of play that could be a real like tour de force performance for the main character, for the main actor rather. And I think Audrey Hepburn really succeeds in it. And yeah, like it speaks to the strength of this story and this script that I think it would be just as effective just as effective on the stage. I love the bit of trivia about this too, where they would darken like all the theater lights to pitch blackness during that final climax, just so the tension is that much more heightened and you're trapped in the dark along with Audrey Hepburn and Alan Arkin. TK, have you perchance seen Wait Until Dark?
No, I'm afraid I haven't, guys. Sorry.
This is one I really think you would enjoy. I mean, as I said, I like to recommend this to just about everyone, but man, this is such a good movie. It's so good. A perfect exercise in tension.
Perfect.
So I guess we've just covered Robin's number two. So TK, what's your number two?
My number two is a Shakespeare play. Like I said, I didn't have any restrictions on myself, so I felt that this was appropriate. Shakespeare's been adapted so many different times and in so many different ways, and it takes a special person to, I think, really encapsulate what Shakespeare was trying to feel and do and present it in such a way that it's comprehensible to a film audience. And I think it lets them, like Little Shop, I think film gives the director some wiggle room to have fun with it. And this is Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet. Because I love this movie. I love watching it. I can watch it for hours and hours and hours. And I have to, because it's 4 hours long. And it's worth, I honestly think it's worth every minute, except for the climax. The climax is terrible. But the rest of the film flows so well, I find. And Branagh has a really... Kenneth makes a very good Hamlet in it as well. And this is another movie where bit players pop up all over the place. But I think that he really captured the spirit of the characters in this. And I think, like, you can do it on stage, but because film allows for editing and redos, it lets him play it until he gets it right. And I really think he does here. And out of any Shakespeare, I think, that's been adapted to the screen, I think this is by far the best. I really do. Just his depth of detail and just how the actors work off each other. It's a great movie, and it's based off a fascinating play. So I think it's an excellent choice to be made in a film. And Branagh, I feel, does it and takes off with it too. What do you guys think, Hamlet?
Well, Kenneth Branagh is sort of, as I said, you know, I could have easily populated this list entirely just with his movies, because he is sort of the go-to director for Shakespearean film adaptations. Hamlet is really good. I mean, he does this sort of definitive version of it that, like you said, it's like 4 hours long. It's very opulent, and it has just an amazing all-star cast. Even the tiniest little bit players are played by these tremendous actors. Honestly, though, I think, and I know it's not a popular opinion, but I think my favorite of Branagh's Shakespeare adaptations is probably Othello with Lawrence Fishburne. But I don't know if he directed Othello, but he played Iago in it. And that's probably my favorite of those ones. This could be a topic for a whole other podcast, is Shakespeare in film. Robin, what do you think of the Branagh adaptation of Hamlet?
Well, you're not going to believe this, but I've never actually watched it. I'm just not a fan of a lot of Shakespeare adaptations. Like, I'll watch them when I'm in the right mood, but I've just never been in the right mood to watch a 4-hour adaptation of it. And I guess that's just why I've never gotten around to watching it. I did give it a mention, though, on my list at the back row from a few years ago, the most baffling Oscar nominations of all time, because I thought it was kind of funny that it got a Best Adapted Screenplay nomination, even though Kenneth Branagh like deliberately chose to like include every piece of Shakespeare's text, so he really didn't have to do a lot of adapting though for it. But I'll give him credit though. From what I've heard, his staging of it is excellent and his casting is excellent. So it's like, if you're going to make a 4-hour version of one of Shakespeare's plays, apparently this is the way to do it.
TK, do you have any thoughts on or either of you guys really? Do you have any thoughts on sort of Branagh's oeuvre, like all of these Shakespeare plays that he's done? Have you seen many others, TK?
I haven't seen a whole bunch of his. That's the only thing. I didn't know he played Iago in his Othello, because now I really want to see it, because Othello's my favorite play and Iago is my favorite character, so that would be super badass.
He does a great job. I really enjoy that one.
He would.
I haven't seen his Henry V, which I really want to, but I've seen Henry V on stage and I'm not enamored with it, but I feel watching it would be really cool. Has he done Richard III? Because I would really like to see him do that.
I believe he has, yes.
Okay, that would be awesome. I'll have to get my hands on that, because that is an excellent, excellent play. I don't know. Brando's got a way of doing Shakespeare that just is really, really cool, and I'm a big fan of his adaptations, and I'll just have to watch a few more of them, I think.
I'm a fan as well. I feel like some succeed and some don't, but Hamlet is certainly sort of like the definitive version. This is a movie that I'd love to own on Blu-ray, actually, just because it's... all the sets are so sweeping, like everything is just so big and almost like luxurious to the point of excess. It really is something. But yeah, it is also confusing that he got a best writing credit on that one, because it's basically just Shakespeare, really.
Yeah.
So my number two, this is another movie adaptation of a play that is confined largely to one location. I am a very big fan of a really good fast-talking farce. I think a fast-talking farce, when done well, can just be perfect comedy. It tickles my funny bone. Something about the style of the farce, it's almost like it's sort of a very clever form of comedy where everything has to match up and all these jokes have these great setups and payoffs, and it can vary between like slapstick humor and verbal humor and humor about misunderstandings, door slamming farces I especially like, but this isn't a door slamming farce. This is one of those fast talking farces by a classic director, Howard Hawks, and the movie is, of course, His Girl Friday. Now, I have never seen the play version of His Girl Friday. And something that I find very interesting, especially because I love the movie version so much, is the fact that they changed the character of Hildy from a man in the play to a woman. It's a very interesting change. And this is, one of the key words of this subject is, of course, adaptation. And here's a case where I feel like the adaptation was probably made one of the strongest changes. And it's probably one of the reasons that His Girl Friday is best known as a movie instead of a play. According to IMDb, in the play, the film was based on the front page. The part of Hildy was played by a man. When director Howard Hawks was planning to make the film, he's going to cast a man. When auditioning actors, a secretary would read the lines belonging to Hildy. Hawks loved the words coming from a woman so much that they decided to rewrite the part for a woman. And one of the big changes, too, is that now the two main characters of Hildy and Walter Burns, who's played by, Hildy is played by Rosalind Russell in the movie, and Walter Burns is now her ex-husband, played by Cary Grant, which adds another layer of, like, terrific verbal conflict that these people, you know, they clearly still, the divorce is still sort of fresh in their minds. There's still all these feelings, these tumultuous feelings of love kicking around as they try to get sort of the ultimate scoop for their newspaper. There's some really funny gags. I love a lot of the verbal dueling. Like, this is one of those classic 1940s movies. It's a newspaper movie, and everybody talks like this, and everybody talks over each other, rapid-fire dialogue, and every other line is a very witty thing, and it's said so pointedly and so quickly that you just have to, you just have to listen very hard to keep up. And so there are just loads and loads of really good little dialogue strings. Verbal dueling is really sort of the best way to put it, between Rosalind Russell and Cary Grant. Like, they do such a great job. But there's also a great gag where Hildy is going to marry this real sort of doofus of a guy, and throughout the film, like, they keep on sort of ignoring his calls or putting him off, and Hildy keeps on making excuses. No, I'll be there, I'll just be late. And she keeps on leaving this guy hanging. It's all very, very clever. We mentioned a Quentin Tarantino connection with Wait Until Dark. I believe Quentin Tarantino has stated that His Girl Friday is one of his favorite movies of all time, and I can totally see why. It's probably one of my favorites as well. Have you guys seen His Girl Friday?
Yes, I have. And about Quentin Tarantino, apparently on the very first page of his Pulp Fiction screenplay, the scene with Pumpkin and Honey Bunny, he writes in the description that they are speaking their dialogue His Girl Friday style. So that just shows the influence that it's had on him. I think he ranked it amongst his top 10 favorite films of all time, which is pretty cool. Yes, this is a really good one. And my experience with it is unique because I think it was in theater when I was at York University. We were studying the stage play The Front Page, where like the Walter and Hildy were both men and there was like no love story involved. And I also saw like a adaptation of it with Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon called The Front Page that they made in the 70s that where they kept it to it and didn't have a love story. So, but it actually kind of enhances the story almost to make Hildy into a fast talking female reporter and have her in a relationship with Walter and bring in like her bland other fiance, even though they totally changed it from the original play. It makes the film like a lot more fun. And this was just kind of almost ahead of its time because you didn't get a lot of films from this time period that had this style of rapid fire or dialogue and stuff. But once this film was a hit, it became very popular. So yeah, I haven't watched this in a while, but this is definitely one of those movies you want to watch like multiple times because the dialogue moves so quickly. You're bound to miss like a bunch of good one-liners here or there. So I'm anxious to revisit it at some point.
TK, have you seen His Girl Friday?
No.
Oh my God! Oh, this is such a classic. Like this really is an absolutely terrific movie. If you haven't watched it by the time like our summer season hits, I'm definitely going to make us do another podcast where we recommend movies to each other, and this is going to be yours because I think you'll really enjoy the rapid fire dialogue, and I think you'll also just really enjoy the staging of it and all the Howard Hawks goodness. You know, as Robin said, you know, this is one of Tarantino's favorite movies. You owe it to yourself to see this, if only to see his influence.
No, totally. I'll totally be on board for it. If Cary Grant's in it, I'm in.
So, TK, what is your number one?
Actually, this is a perfect segue. Whenever we were first talked about this topic last week, we ended the call and I'm like, oh, shit, movies based on plays. And I tried to remember a few that I could think of off the top of my head. And I'm like, oh, no, I can't really think of anything. And then later on in the weekend, it finally hit me like a bolt of lightning. And it was absolutely wonderful because one of my favorite movies of all time is based on a stage play. And in fact, two of the actresses in it, in the film, are actually lifted directly from the stage. Like they acted on the stage version and then went into the movie. And Cary Grant tie-in is perfect because it's Arsenic and Old Lace. I would love to see this as a play. I really would, just to see the constant because the film takes place almost entirely in the living room of I can't remember his name now. Mortimer Brewster. It takes place entirely in the Brewster sisters' front hallway. And I would love to see this live. And there's a whole bunch of in jokes that like transpired from the stage to the film. Mortimer's brother Jonathan shows up, and Jonathan was sent away when he was a kid because he was an awful child, and he broke out, and he's had plastic surgery to make him look different. And the running joke is that everyone says he looks like Boris Karloff, and he gets really angry when people say that. And the reason that joke made it into the film is because Boris Karloff played Jonathan in the stage version, which I think is really cool. I like this as a film because I love Cary Grant in it, and I think he'd have the same energy on stage, but I don't think it would feel the same. Again, like I was talking about earlier with Hamlet, because you can keep doing things, you can keep doing take after take after take until you get it right. I think Arsenic would make makes a good film because it allows the actors to get things down pat. And there's a whole bunch of physical jokes that like if they went wrong on stage, I feel would ruin a whole bunch of stuff. But because once you have it on film, it's easier to keep going over and over again on it. It's an excellent story, and I just feel it adapts well. And I'm kind of I recommend this movie to almost anyone I see that has any interest in film who hasn't seen it, because it's cute and it's funny, and it's just such a goofy movie, and it's such a good role for Grant. I feel I really think he had fun with this. So it's a great movie to see, and I know you guys have seen it, because I can't remember, because I've talked about this on the cast before. I just can't remember if it's happened.
I have seen both the movie, and I've seen the play version of Arsenic and Old Lace. I've actually seen the play done more times than I have actually seen the movie, and frankly, I don't think there's that big of a difference. Like this is a pretty good translation of the source material into a film. And this is another terrific example of a great farce, a really good comedy, largely confined to one location, but it's a location where different things, you know, different parts of the set become more important as it goes on. Like there's a body in the window seat, and so now all the attention's on the window seat, and things like where they're trying to hide the body and, you know, look casual and things like that. It just becomes all the funnier because we, the audience, are now in on this secret where, even if you don't, in the play, certainly you really don't see the body in the window seat. And, you know, that it still carries this comedy because, you know, there's one there. I really feel like the play and the movie are comparable because they're so, it's such a faithful adaptation that in my mind there's very little difference, except of course for the inclusion of Cary Grant. Robin, have you seen the play version perchance of Arsenic Old Lace?
I haven't, no. I've seen the movie version though, and I just had a gut feeling that TK was going to pick this as his number one because he talks about this film a lot. But I haven't watched it in a while, but it is like a lot of fun, and it's kind of funny looking at it in the filmography of Frank Capra, because he was known for more of his like lighthearted, like inspirational movies, and not known for doing like kind of dark comedies, but it kind of works here because he's doing like a dark comedy in a lighthearted farce style, and it works pretty well. And of course Cary Grant, I think, like adds a lot to like the role of it because he's just so funny in it. It has like a fun cast as well. I particularly love Peter Lorre in it as well. The only thing I regretted about it is that apparently Boris Karloff originally played the role of Jonathan Brewster in the stage version with the whole running gag. He looks like Karloff, but they were unable to cast him in the film, I think, because of a scheduling conflict or something, but that would have been cool. But yeah, it still holds up like really well, and it's one of the best farces, I think, or stage to screen farces ever produced.
Robin, what's your number one?
My number one is 12 Angry Men, one of my all-time favorites. I still remember like how I first became familiar with this film in high school. We were studying like 12 Angry Men, the play, in my English class, and I thought it was like a really great play, and I thought it like.
Sorry?
Version of, and I was kind of. Are you losing me?
Yeah, please just repeat that last thing. I have you now.
Okay, yeah. I first studied 12 Angry Men in high school and in my English class, and I remember reading the play thinking, like, it was really good, and it came off, like, really well on paper. And then our teacher was going to show us, like, the film version. And afterwards, and I kept getting skeptical. Okay, is this really going to make a compelling film? Because, like, these characters just sitting around a table in one jury room talking the entire time. But then he showed it to us, and I was just, like, totally riveted to it. Like, as you know, I'm a huge Sidney Lumet fan, and this is the film that kind of put him on the map because it just seemed like such a difficult task to do, like, a 95-minute movie where you almost never leave this claustrophobic jury room and stuff, and it's basically guys just discussing a case while sitting around the table, but it's like really, really riveting stuff and fascinating. And it has such a great story arc where like you have 11 men who are going to vote like guilty like right away. But this one character played by Henry Fonda has reasonable doubt. And by the end of it, he converts them all like one by one until they all vote not guilty in the end. And I think what makes it work well is that they all have very distinct characters, because even though you never even learn the names of these characters, they're all just known under their number, like number one, number two. They all have like very distinctive personalities. Like, I particularly like Lee J. Cobb as like the father who has such a chip on his shoulder about his failed relationship with his son that he wants to convict this, boy and send him to the death chamber, even though he might not be guilty. And then you have the racist character, and then you have the character played by Jack Warden, who just wants to leave and get to the baseball game, so he's willing to change his vote and go to the majority. And then you have like the stockbroker, who's like very logical oriented, and it takes forever to get him to change his mind, but he will admit when he's wrong and stuff. Really fascinating stuff, and it almost moves kind of like in real time. Like it's like a 90-minute movie, and it's almost just 90 minutes of being in the room, and Sidney Lumet does like great things to ratchet up the tension in there, because he has stuff like the fan breaks down so it becomes really hot, and then they open the windows and then a thunderstorm comes and the sound of the storm kind of pervades over the scene. It's a great way to keep the visuals interesting even while you're still in the same location. And I guess the material is just so good that it's very easy to make this type of material into a compelling film. I know they did a made-for-cable remake directed by William Friedkin in the 90s, which was also very good, but it still didn't measure up to this. This is still my favorite movie based on a play, and I still watch it frequently every year. It's like no matter how many times I've seen it, I still get riveted and find myself wondering, ooh, how are they going to convert this juror to change his mind and stuff? It really lends itself to repeat viewings, I think.
This is a total classic. This is one that I actually left it off my list just because it's sort of like it's almost like the standard by which all other stage play to movie adaptations are measured. And in a way, it's almost a case of the movie adaptation becoming better known than the original. But in a way, the stage play is still just as well known at the same time. A very unique case, and the kind of thing that, you know, once again, it speaks to the strength of this story, that you could do this adaptation any number of different ways, and it would still be just as great, just based on the strength of all the characters and the situation that they're in. TK, this is one that I know you've seen.
12 Angry Men? I haven't seen 12 Angry
you
Men.
You haven't seen 12 Angry Men?
Oh, my God.
No. As I've said before in this podcast, the list of movies I haven't seen is long and shameful.
Not a student of the theater.
No, I'm sorry.
Well, fair enough. So, my number one pick, I think I'm cheating here. I couldn't remember if I picked this as my favorite musical, but the Rocky Horror Picture Show, guys. It's all about the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Deliberately left it off my list.
There is a reason that I love Rocky Horror as much as I do, and it's not just because I was one of those kids, those theater kids who discovered Rocky Horror Picture Show when I was like 15 years old, and you know, I was just totally enamored with the audacity of it. Even though I'm a pretty vanilla dude, I've got to say there is something kind of appealing about this fantasy world where you can be totally liberated in who you are, where you don't even have to identify as male or female or gay or straight or bisexual. You can just be whoever you want to be. The mantra of Rocky Horror Picture Show is don't dream it, be it. And I totally love that sentiment. I think that sentiment is worth repeating. It's worth chanting. It's worth singing the way they sing it. Tim Curry delivers a tremendous performance as Dr. Frankenfurter. As I said, I discovered this in my teenage years, and so of course I like to help out at the local theater, and I dress up as the character Riff Raff, and me and some of the other sort of local theater folks would do a floor show performance in front of the movie screen whenever they screened Rocky Horror. And the fellow, his name is Matt, who played Frankenfurter, he said that, and he did a great job, and he said that the challenge with Frankenfurter is at once you have to be as macho as John Wayne and as feminine as Marilyn Monroe. And I've always remembered that as sort of like the perfect description of the role of Frankenfurter, because it's so odd, you know, like, I'm not gay, but Tim Curry is kind of sexy. He pulls off this amazing kind of charisma, even though he looks pretty weird and he wears some really wild clothing. It's really quite the phenomenon. The fact that Richard O'Brien, who wrote the stage play, is also one of the stars of the movie is very appropriate, and it means that everything has this real sort of accurate detail that you can tell that this is a good adaptation when it has not only the creator's seal of approval but his active participation. The songs are all terrific. They're all really great rock and roll. I've always felt very envious of Richard O'Brien's ability to write songs like that. In the interviews for Rocky Horror, he talks about how for him, writing the songs of the Rocky Horror Picture Show was like filling out a crossword puzzle. He just has such an innate understanding of music that he can just construct whatever song he wants just off the top of his head. And frankly, I think most of the songs of Rocky Horror are all just awesome tunes. I mean, the Time Warp is sort of overplayed, but even things like Whatever Happened to Saturday Night, as sung by Meatloaf, or the entire floor show sequence, which I think I listed as one of my favorite musical sequences. It's all just so much fun. And this is a unique case. It's almost an entirely unique case. I think it certainly set the standard for the idea of the cult midnight movie where everybody dresses up and there is audience participation and interaction. So in a way, even though Rocky Horror Picture Show is a film, it remained a kind of a form of theater, because part of the point of watching Rocky Horror, it's not just to watch the movie. You've got to sing along. You've got to dress up. You've got to take part, throw things, yell stuff out, and have a jolly old time. Once again, don't dream it, be it. Now, TK, this is one you've seen.
Seen, participated, dressed up for, yes. Yeah, I love.
Who did
love,
you play? Were you Brad Majors?
Of course it was Brad Majors. That's a ridiculous question. For those of you who have never seen me, I have a goatee. When I was younger in high school, I obviously did not. And with my glasses and the way I had my hair cut, I looked exactly like Brad Majors. And I had the costume, brown pants, the sweater vest, the top, everything. It was wonderful. I love seeing Rocky Horror. It's one of the this one group of friends I had in high school. It's what we did. It's like we would go over to each other's houses and throw Rocky Horror on in the background and just talk. And it would just like the songs I have memorized. My favorite fact about Rocky Horror: the opening song, Science Fiction Double Feature, is sung by Richard O'Brien, and I never believed that at all until I saw it.
Sung by Richard O'Brien, but the lips belong to Patricia O'Quinn.
Yeah, which I always thought was pretty cool. And it's just such a cool play. Richard O'Brien's a musical genius. He's so friggin' weird too, and that's why I like it so much. He took this kind of odd flair to it, and like you were saying earlier, Gil, the "Don't Dream It, Be It" thing. It's true. It's 100% true. And this film kind of shows just where you, if you want to be somewhere else, just change it. And it's great. I love Rocky Horror to death. I think it's just wonderful. Avoid the sequel. God.
Except for the music.
Yeah, no, you're right. The music is badass, but avoid it just for the...
Yeah, the movie is not good, but the music, especially the title song, Shock Treatment, again, just totally catchy and pretty brilliant stuff by Richard O'Brien. Robin, what do you think of Rocky Horror?
I remember you did mention this on the musical one, and I actually had forgotten this was a stage musical first before it was a movie, so I never would have thought about including this one on this list. But yeah, like I said on the musical podcast, I've never really had the full Rocky Horror Picture Show experience. Like, I've only watched it at like home, I think once or twice, and I've never seen it in a theater and like never dressed up as one of the characters or watched it with an audience. And I just kind of had the
eh reaction to it. But that's how a lot of people feel about it, though. They say that if you just watch it at home, then it's just kind of like a forgettable musical in that you have to watch it, like, with a big audience in a theater to get the full experience of it. So I can't say I have an objective opinion for it because I've never seen it in that environment. But, like, as far as I know, it just has been completely forgettable to me. But maybe one of these days I will check it out in that full environment.
Another part of it too, I really do feel like discovering it at the right time is sort of a key thing. I know a lot of people, like TK and myself, who you discover it when you are in those early to mid teenage years, when you're still sort of growing and developing an understanding of sexuality and sexual liberation. And also that was right around the time where, like, I really started to love rock and roll. It's sort of like the perfect time for Rocky Horror, because Rocky Horror it's essentially saying, like, be whoever the hell you want to be. There's somewhere that will accept you here. You can be whoever you want here. You know, you can dress up in women's clothing and high heels if you want. Nobody's going to judge you at Rocky Horror. And, again, just that sentiment of acceptance, of liberation, I think it's kind of admirable. And, I love the fact that Rocky Horror is still playing today. You can, if you're lucky on Halloween, you can still get into a midnight screening, but good luck, because if you, like us, if you're in a town where only one theater shows Rocky Horror at midnight on Halloween, you better arrive like hours early. I can't count the number of years I went to line up and they just sold out the whole theater before I could even get in the door. So that covers our favorite movies based on plays, but I actually have a pretty long list of other movies I want to talk about, and I gotta talk about Les Miserables. So I'm gonna open the honorable mentions by talking about Tom Hooper's Les Miserables, nominated for Best Picture this year. Have either of you guys had a chance to see it yet?
No, not yet.
Sadly, no.
All right, so, there are a few problems, the biggest of which is Russell Crowe. I don't really have anything against Russell Crowe. He's never going to be one of my favorite actors, but I've certainly seen him act well in some really solid movies. I'm thinking of stuff like L.A. Confidential he was really good in. I mean, Gladiator, I don't think that he was particularly superb, but that's a good movie, and he certainly wasn't bad at all. He was pretty badass in that film. He did sing, like, early in his career, and I guess sort of on the side now, he was kind of known for his singing. I believe, Robin, you've posted it before, there were Starz clip of him as, what's his name, like Johnny LaRocque or something like that?
Russ LaRocque. It was
Russ,
like,
LaRocque.
Yeah, when he was like in his early 20s, he had a music alter ego. It was basically like a parody of like a 50s, 60s rock musician, and he actually became kind of got a cult following in the 80s in Australia for it, and released a few hit singles and stuff before he turned to acting.
And he also has his own band called 30 Odd Foot of Grunts. And let me tell you, that's got to be the most apt description of Russell Crowe singing, because he just, like, grunts and groans every song. You can tell when he sings that he has a really limited range, and he sort of sings like someone's punching him in the gut. All his song, he doesn't sing from his diaphragm, and all his singing, oh, feels very strained. So anytime he was singing, oh God, you know, I felt sort of like, just shoot me. This is terrible. The production values are quite good. The costumes are really well done. But the biggest problem I had with this movie, besides Russell Crowe, was it kind of felt to me like Tom Hooper wanted to tell the story of Les Miserables, the story of Jean Valjean, and it's almost like he didn't want it to be a musical, just because he directs the whole thing with a real sense of realism. Like, he's clearly trying to root this film in the real world, but it's an opera. Les Mis is an opera, and as a result, it just doesn't suit the cinematic medium. Because, you know, movies, you have the advantage of being able to get as close to your performers as you want. which means that they can act a lot with a single look, with a look in their eye. But in Les Mis, they sing everything they're thinking. And they sing it all the time. And they sing everything they're thinking and feeling. And they also sing every little silly little interaction. And that works on stage. It can be just fine on stage. But in a movie, it just does not flow. The songs end up feeling too long. I started getting annoyed anytime you could, like, spoiler alert for Les Mis, I'll say. I mean, come on, guys. The play's been around for a very long time. But there is the moment where Javert realizes or suspects that the man he has just met is in fact Jean Valjean, who has adopted a new identity. And in the movie, you get sort of this close-up, and you see Russell Crowe, who plays Javert. He gets this suspicious look. And in that look, you can tell he recognizes this guy. But then he opens his mouth, and he's like, I think I recognize this guy. He reminds me of a prisoner I saw early on. You know, like, and he just sings and sings and sings. And it all felt extraneous to me. It just all felt so extraneous. Because everything is conveyed in the acting in a movie. Everything is conveyed in the acting in a movie. And unlike a traditional musical, where you have scenes of dialogue and acting and then musical numbers, Les Mis is just singing all the way straight through. And like I said, even the smallest little interaction where they're like, hello, sir, can you spare some change? I'm really poor, you know, like, just everything that they say is done in a sort of a sing-song way. Now, another reason I say I think that Tom Hooper didn't want to make this a musical but felt like he had to at the same time, I think it's his choice to record all of the singing live on set. I can understand that being sort of this honorable thing. You know, he wants to capture the singing the way you would capture it in a play by having the actors actually sing it. But one of the problems is that it's therefore not the most polished recording of the songs. And there are times, like in the opening number, where Hugh Jackman is singing and he is being sprayed by torrents of water. So half the time he's singing and half the other time he's just, like, trying to catch his breath. I also felt like there were a few times where you could tell that the actors had done a few takes before the one that they used, because it's almost like they were getting tired of belting out these songs. And I should also say that Russell Crowe, he never belts out a single thing. He does not commit to the role at all. Worth noting, though, is Anne Hathaway. You know, she's in the movie for a very short time, but her big song, I Dreamed a Dream, she gives it her all. Really good. She did a great job. I don't know if I would nominate her for Best Supporting Actress, especially because she's in the film so little, but her song is really terrific. And Hugh Jackman, he's trying. He's really trying his damnedest. He's got this theatrical background, and there are a number of times where he does really try to give it his all. But I don't know. There are just a lot of problems with this movie, too. Another great example of how I think the on-set recording of the music was a mistake is there is a scene, a sword fight between Valjean and Javert. You can tell that it's pretty damn hard to sing and sword fight at the same time. And as a result, the sword fight ends up being kind of wimpy and kind of unimpressive. They're really clearly holding back because they're focusing so much on trying to get the music out. There are some really good, I wish I had the names of the actors, but there are some good supporting actors. The woman who plays Eponine, who have clearly got this theatrical background, but I don't know, you know, it doesn't quite work for me. One last thought is because it's singing all the way through, it really draws attention in the movie to how this was clearly written to accommodate a stage where it bounces very rhythmically between these small songs between like one, two, or three people, and these giant numbers where it's like, you know, 20 to 50 people all involved at the same time. And while I was watching it, all I could think of was whenever it went to like one of these personal small songs with one, two, or three people, how the lights, the stage lights would go down and it'd be those people in a spotlight. And while that was going on, they'd be getting all the other actors ready for the big number. And then the lights would come up and there'd be a big number. You really feel that style of pacing when you watch this movie. So I wanted to mention it here because it's certainly not the worst play to movie adaptation I've ever seen. It's not the worst musical I've ever seen, but it's also far from the best. It could have been so much more, but I almost feel like this was kind of a misguided attempt. And sadly, in a lot of cases, a waste of good talent. I did like Sacha Baron Cohen and Helena Bonham Carter in it, but in a way, they feel like they belonged in an entirely different movie. They have this one last example, actually, of how it's sort of like the music is getting in the way of the acting, where their number, they do it all very drunkenly, but the result is that the music isn't very good, even if their acting is, and then vice versa. If the singing's really good, then they don't have time to act, and if they act too much, then they lose the power of the singing. So, I don't know, guys. Those are my thoughts on Les Mis. I'll be interested to hear your thoughts on it. Are either of you fans of the play, or at least the soundtrack of the play?
Interestingly enough, I remember being taken to see Les Mis the musical about 20 years ago when I was in grade school, and at the time I really loved it and was like, oh, I really hope somebody makes a movie of this someday, and here it is almost like 20 years later and they finally made a movie musical version. I know they've made like a straight version, the one with Liam Neeson, but by now I'm really not overly excited to see it, unfortunately.
I think it's the kind of thing that, it's an opera, you know. We've seen musicals adapted, but how many operas have we seen adapted into movies? And I feel like opera is just, it's too rooted in the theatrical medium to work very well in a movie, or certainly in this case. TK,
One thing I wanted to mention about, since you mentioned Rocky Horror Picture Show, is that I actually have a clip on the back row of Before They Were Stars of Russell Crowe in a production of the Rocky Horror Picture Show during the 1980s when he was still in college. And he plays the role of Dr. Scott, and I'm presuming his singing in that is a lot better than his singing in Les Mis.
Most likely, I'll have to watch that. But I mean, the other thing too is that Dr. Scott is not, he doesn't demand the vocal range that Javert certainly does.
Yeah.
TK, are you a fan of Les Mis in any way, shape, or form?
I read the book years ago, the Victor Hugo novel, but I've never seen it or heard. Actually, the only thing I've heard of it is that Susan Boyle cover.
Oh, wow. Really?
I haven't heard anything about it.
In that case, I'm actually quite excited to get your thoughts on the movie adaptation, because you'll be coming from sort of a very fresh perspective.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
So let's talk a bit about honorable mentions. You guys have some honorable mentions that you of great movies based on plays?
Do I ever? Sorry, I'm going to jump in.
Sure.
The movie Brigadoon was a movie that my mom really liked when she was when I was really little. Like, she still likes it, but it's a movie that I remember watching a lot when I was younger, and it's based on a stage play. Can't go on this subject without mentioning Glengarry Glen Ross.
Really. Yeah. And that's another one where I really almost feel like the movie is much better known than the play.
Yeah. We talked about Rocky Horror. The Hitchcock movie Rope started out as a stage play, and it's one of my favorite Hitchcock flicks. Sweeney Todd, The Demon Barber of Fleet Street. I love the Tim Burton remake. It has a special place in my heart. And I feel that from what you're talking about Russell Crowe, Gil, I feel that I can draw comparisons to Alan Rickman, because he plays a baritone, but there's no way he can sing.
I was actually thinking while I was watching Les Mis that Russell Crowe and Alan Rickman should get together and do their own musical, because they have about the same range.
The musical Chicago actually started as a stage play, and I've seen the Chicago musical done on stage, and I've seen it on screen. I am a fan of them both. And actually, Bela Lugosi's Dracula is actually based off a play that was done in the 20s. And you can't go wrong with classic Bela Lugosi. And, okay, we talked, I think we mentioned this when we were discussing this podcast topic. Where does the producers line up on this? Because the producers was a film, then it was a musical, then it was a film redone again about a musical.
Just in terms of my opinion, and I feel like we can sort of get into this a bit more after our honorable mentions. I think that the first version of the producers, the one before they made it into a Broadway hit with Matthew Broderick, I think that original version is great. And then it's somehow I feel like they kind of bungled it up when they tried to redo the Broadway version as a movie.
And that's all the honorable mentions I have, gentlemen.
So, Robin, do you have any honorable mentions?
Yeah, I have quite a few. The movie Doubt with Meryl Streep, Philip Seymour Hoffman, and Amy Adams. I think I talked about that quite a bit on our religious podcast, but I'm a huge fan of that movie. It's an excellent adaptation. Also, I completely forgotten this was based on a stage play, but A Few Good Men by Aaron Sorkin. Like, it's such an iconic movie that I was just looking through a list of, like, movies based on plays, and I forgot that Aaron Sorkin originally wrote it as a stage play, but it would make perfect sense since so much of it takes place in a courtroom. But that's another terrific one. Also, Stalag 17, the old World War II POW movie with William Holden, directed by Willie Wilder. That one's also a classic as well. A movie that I've written about in Robin's underrated gems, The Hill, directed by Sidney Lumet, which takes place in a military detention camp in like North Africa, which is one of the most miserable settings I've ever seen in a movie. This very hot sun out there in like the middle of the desert and stuff, and it's got a terrific performance by Sean Connery in this, one of his career best, and also a terrific one by Ozzie Davis as well. So that one's another classic. Another Hitchcock one, Dial M for Murder. That's another terrific adaptation of a stage play as well. And yeah, I think that's about it for me for honorable mentions.
I got a number here.
Oh, sorry. Also the movie Sleuth with Laurence Olivier and Michael Caine, based on a stage play by Anthony Schaefer. That's another underrated one, I think.
Unfortunately, I wasn't as keen on the Kenneth Branagh-directed Michael Caine Jude Law version of Sleuth.
Yeah, I've never seen the remake yet, actually, but I heard it was far inferior.
Some of my honorable mentions, the movie Quills, you know, I think the movie Quills is a really good one, and I can only imagine how traumatic that would be as a play, because the movie is intense, but also just really terrific, and a tour de force performance for Jeffrey Rush, certainly. I talked before about farces, my love of farces. Another really terrific play-to-movie adaptation of a good farce is Noises Off, starring Michael Caine and the late John Ritter. And it's also just hilarious. It's almost like sort of an Inception-esque level of meta-ness to Noises Off, where it's a movie about Michael Caine trying to put on a farce. And then the story of him trying to put that farce on is itself a farce. It's really terrific, and just so many great rapid-fire gags. Let's see. You guys mentioned Sleuth. You mentioned 12 Angry Men. I mean, there's Death of a Salesman, A Streetcar Named Desire, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. If you want to talk Shakespeare, we've done the Branagh version. There's the Zeffirelli Romeo and Juliet. There's Romeo and Juliet by Baz Luhrmann, which is certainly a really interesting adaptation. Even if you are not keen on the Baz Luhrmann adaptation of Romeo and Juliet, it's certainly a really neat sort of modern update that shows how timeless the story of Romeo and Juliet really is. Speaking of interesting adaptations, how about Akira Kurosawa's Throne of Blood? Have either of you guys seen that one?
Oh, no, I haven't, but I had no idea it was based off a stage play.
It's based off of Macbeth, of all things.
Oh,
it's,
yeah.
And it's another really just fascinating adaptation where it is an adaptation in a very true sense of the word. Amadeus is based on a play. I didn't know that until I was doing research for this podcast. Harvey is another classic film. I feel like the another one where the film is almost better known than the play by today's standards. And then, of course, you could just go down the rabbit hole of musicals and name off any number of them, like Chicago, or if you wanted to talk about Grease, which I think is a problematic movie but with some great catchy songs, et cetera, et cetera. See also our movie musicals podcast for more information on that stuff.
Oh, and I should say as an honorable mention also Casablanca, because technically it's based on an unproduced stage play. So even though I don't think it was ever performed, technically Casablanca, one of the most famous films of all time, based on a play.
Do you guys have any picks for the worst movies based on plays?
Yeah, this is an interesting one. I wound up watching this with my mother a couple years ago. It's Barbara Streisand's Yentl, which is which is a musical version based on a stage play. And this movie is probably one of the biggest ego strokes ever for like a major star, because she is just so badly miscast in this, because the storyline is that she plays a girl who chops off all her hair and then disguises herself as a boy, like a Jewish boy, to get inside like a yeshiva and stuff. And she's just so unconvincing, and it's so hilarious to see like Mandy, she falls in love with Mandy Patinkin playing this other character, and he has these sexual attractions to her, but he's so confused because he thinks she's a boy. And then there's another woman character played by Amy Irving who is attracted to him, even though Barbara Streisand makes a really ugly boy. So I don't know like how either of these characters are attracted to her. And there's a grand total. Barbara Streisand sings 12 songs in the course of the film, and most of them are soliloquy solos and stuff. So apparently there are a lot of people who really love this movie, and apparently like if you are a Barbara Streisand fan, this may be the greatest film of all time, because she just sings so much and she's like the center of attention in every scene. But if you're not a Barbara Streisand fan, then this movie is really, really stupid.
I have not seen Yentl. I've actually seen very few Barbara Streisand movies.
Now, I've seen Hello, Dolly, and, like, I can only imagine, like, if she had to do a whole bunch of, like, soliloquy-like songs, how that would not carry the movie very well. It's too bad.
Did you have any other contenders for the worst of all time?
I don't know too many bad ones. I guess for another bad musical, I would probably list Paint Your Wagon, which apparently was a really good, musical on stage, but when they cast Clint Eastwood and Lee Marvin and made them sing, the end results were disastrous. But, this is a case where it's probably more well known for the parody on The Simpsons rather than the actual movie these days.
And what's amazing is I saw that Simpsons parody long before I even knew the movie was real and existed, and that parody is pretty close, actually. there's a lot of truth in that parody.
You're not the only one I've heard say that, who say, oh my god, I had no idea that was a real movie.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. TK, do you have any picks for the worst movies based on plays?
I actually don't, because like out of the lists I found, I actually haven't seen a whole bunch of them, so I couldn't really comment. I'm really sorry. I couldn't think of one.
All right, I got three. This is good, because I have a nice wide variety here. So for a really bad musical movie based on a play, Mamma Mia is a problematic musical. I don't think the adaptation was done particularly well, but it gets a mention here. Not because it is a terrible movie overall, but mainly because Pierce Brosnan is just awful in it. You know what? That's sort of my fantasy bad musical, is to have Pierce Brosnan from Mamma Mia, Russell Crowe from Les Miserables, and Alan Rickman from Sweeney Todd. Put them all in a movie together and make them sing. It would be hilarious.
I was thinking the exact same thing. It's not a bad movie overall, but that may be like the worst musical performance of all time in a movie.
He is so bad. He is really bad in Mamma Mia. You've Got Mail is based on, I think it's called The Shop Around the Corner. Which I believe was a play and then a movie, and then that movie was remade as You've Got Mail. I just think this is so bland. This is so clearly Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan trying to recapture the success of Sleepless in Seattle. But I don't like You've Got Mail. And boy, talk about such a dated premise now. You've Got Mail. When was the last time you ever heard anyone mention America Online? Like, that was just such a brief little flash in the pan. It would be like a MySpace movie today, right? Like, oh, boy.
I will say though that I've never watched it, but it's my mother's all-time favorite movie. So,
oh my god, really?
For saying this, yeah.
Why not Sleepless in Seattle? Just watch Sleepless in Seattle. That's such a better movie, and it's not.
Or watch The Little Shop Around the Corner.
Yes, yes, exactly. Yeah. Like those are way better. Why You've Got Mail, America on. That, oh man, you know, I'd almost like to watch it just to see all the big clunky computers and dial-up modems. You just know that there is at least one scene where Tom Hanks is like, oh boy, I bet she sent me an email, and then you get to watch him slowly connect to the internet. Apparently Meet Joe Black was based on a play. I don't like that movie. It's just, again, totally bland in my books. And then finally, I had to put it here, even though technically it's not really based on the play, but Romeo and Juliet, the recent animated movie. I mean, it's sort of right there in the title saying it's blatantly Romeo and Juliet, but I don't know. Gnomes? Terrible. So I thought we could also just briefly touch on, we've already sort of mentioned it, but plays that were based on movies. And let's start with the producers. It's such a weird phenomenon to have. It started as a movie. A movie about two guys putting on a play, and then it was adapted to be this big Broadway hit, and it's a play about putting on a play that's based on a movie about putting on a play, and then that Broadway hit was remade as a movie. Like, it's, again, we're talking Inception levels of meta text here. I don't know, guys. What do you make of that? Robin, have you seen both versions of the producers?
Yes, I definitely prefer the old Mel Brooks version. I remember watching the remake version, the musical version, and I know it was directed by the same person who directed the stage show, and all I could think is this person has no idea how to direct a movie, because I just thought it was, like, clunkily staged and stuff, and that it just did not translate well to the screen at all. But
it's so odd. It's so odd to think about, like, it was a movie to begin with. How did the remake go so wrong?
Yeah, it's just very bizarre. I mean, I heard that, like, I know a lot of the musical numbers put in there, a lot of people who are fans of the original producers kind of complain that it feels like padding, that, like, the story is just so strong without it that all you really need is, like, the Springtime for Hitler number and stuff, but a lot of the new ones that they wrote in for the Broadway just don't really add to the story at all, but it became a big success, so it worked.
Yeah, and I think we've already mentioned one in this podcast already, but Robin, was one of the movies on your, one of the films on your list, like a movie and then a play and then a movie again or something along those lines?
I think we were talking about Little Shop of Horrors.
That's right.
Yeah. You never would have thought the original was going to become a musical someday, but it did.
It's just a very interesting phenomenon. I don't know what that says about the nature of sort of intellectual properties like that. But, yeah, really odd. As far as other plays based on movies, I actually wrote, if you look up my article, Movie the Musical, I think it was last year, or maybe even the year before, that I wrote on The Back Row, where I sort of break down the phenomenon of, the stage play based on a movie. And, the prime example that I've seen is Evil Dead the Musical. I've seen a couple of productions of Evil Dead the Musical now. And what can I say? I mean, it's really fun. It's done with all the sort of camp and sort of gory humor that Evil Dead has done, with some pretty creative songs. It's definitely the kind of thing that you can tell just a few fans of the movie put together and somehow managed to get realized. But it's a good time. But there are all sorts. Like, there was a musical version of Silence of the Lambs. There was a musical version of High Fidelity, I remember. And, like, Shrek became a musical stage play. Beauty and the Beast. The Beauty and the Beast and the Julie Taymor's Lion King stage play, they were, like, they're a big deal. They became, like, really big and famous. But it's sort of interesting. Do you guys... What do you guys think of that? Do you think, for some reason, some part of my brain kind of feels like it's almost like cheating in a way, like it, but, you know, maybe that's just me giving priority to film and thinking that film is like the pinnacle of these art forms and that you can't have it the other way. You can't make a movie into something else. You can only make things into movies. I mean, it
is kind of true because I honestly haven't seen most of these musicals on stage, so I don't know how well they turned out. I mean, I guess it could work for like a niche project. I mean, I haven't seen any of the musical versions, but Reefer Madness is another one where it's basically this big cult item and it got turned into a stage musical. And apparently later on, they made a film version of that musical. I mean, I don't know if it was any good or not, but I guess with something like Reefer Madness, where it is just such a bad movie altogether that I guess it's okay to turn that into a musical. But it's like some other ones, like I heard there was a musical of like Carrie, like Stephen King's Carrie. And it's like that just sounds like someone getting a random idea in their head and wanting to try it, but it's just like, what's the point? It's not material that lends itself to a musical.
Yeah, exactly. When you look at things like Silence of the Lambs, the musical, or Carrie the musical, you kind of think like, this is a joke, right? Like they're doing it. This is something that just started off as a joke that somebody's doing just, you know, for fun to say that it like almost like it lives based on the strength of its title. Just saying, like, blank the musical, ahaha, isn't that funny? Evil Dead the musical, I was sort of skeptical at first that that's what it was. And maybe in a way it is, because they do it all very tongue-in-cheek. But something great about Evil Dead the musical, when you see it live, is that the first few rows of the audience are in what's called the splatter zone, where they have, at different points in the play, they have, like, blasts of gore and fake blood sprays all over the stage, and anyone in the first few rows is likely to get splattered as well. That's a nice little touch that sort of sets it apart and makes the adaptation of Evil Dead into a stage play worthwhile, because they do things like that to set it apart from the movie. TK,
I will say, though, that if they made a musical based on Planet of the Apes for real, I would go see it.
if they use the songs from The Simpsons, if they got the same people from The Simpsons to do it, to do the writing for it, then totally, because that was great. Or even Streetcar Named Desire as a musical, they do it. Hey, Streetcar, that was really fun, too. TK, you brought up the producers. Do you have any further thoughts on that one?
Not really.
Have you seen both versions?
Yeah, and I actually prefer the modern one because of the music. I think it's much better than the first one.
Oh,
really?
A controversial opinion.
I like it a lot better. That's just me.
And do you have any thoughts on like this the inverse phenomenon? Are you sort of a film snob like Robin and I, where you're like, why would you make Silence of the Lambs do a musical?
See, I like stage adaptations because I go and see a lot of them. I think if artistic license lets people do what they want, people do what they want, and you're not going to stop them. It's just whether or not the end product comes out is good. And I'm willing to watch pretty much anything. So,
I would be interested to see. It almost seems like too often these plays based on movies are just doing the musical version of a movie. And I'd really like to see, like, you know what would be a great play is that Ryan Reynolds movie Buried. That would be great as a play. Yeah, that would totally work. You could totally do that. I would love to see someone take a movie property that lends itself, or even that movie Phone Booth with Colin Farrell. You know, these are both cases of movies that are based around a single location, so obviously you could do them pretty easily on stage. But again, you know, they're the kind of simple stories that would allow a handful of actors to do a really good job and put in really good performances. And I'd be more curious to see stage adaptations of those sorts of stories. I hear that there was a really good stage adaptation of Reservoir Dogs that was put on, where the audience, they do it in a warehouse, and the audience was seated in the middle of the set, and then people would come in from all around, and like action would happen on all sides of you. Like that, to me, would be really interesting to see. But it does seem like all too often they just do it sort of as a joke and put the subtitle "The Musical" on the end of it.
Wow, I that was my first thought, is that Reservoir Dogs would be a great stage play, and now I found out they actually did one. But like, that's a terrific source of material of something you can do on stage where the material just speaks for itself.
Exactly. It's just a really tense story with, and it's all about these actors and their dialogue. I mean, that's sort of a perfect little version. I'd love to see the Reservoir Dogs play. I think that would be amazing. That's sort of all my thoughts on plays based on movies. Do you guys have any other comments on this?
Not really, no, but I will say that I am surprised at that more of the ones that I've seen have been adapted very well rather than very badly. So it seems that some of the material in plays is good enough that it lends itself to both stage and play. I guess if you write good enough material, it doesn't matter what medium it's in.
Yeah, absolutely. There are actually, just in the course of this conversation, there were two movies based on plays that I have to mention. One that would go in my sort of best of category, might even crack my top five if I did a top five, but L'Cage aux Folles is a really terrific one. And I don't mean The Birdcage with Robin Williams and Nathan Lane. Yeah, that was fine, I guess. But
hang on a second. The Birdcage was a play?
Yeah, it was a French
play.
Okay,
can I change my number one? Because, like, I love The Birdcage more than life itself.
have you seen the French film, L'Cage aux
Folles? No, I haven't.
Watch that, because it is fantastic. It is really terrific. And I saw the stage play, which is a musical, and there are some really great numbers, like where I can't remember the characters' names, but where the one guy is teaching his lover how to eat like a man, and how to sit like a man, and how to eat your toast like a man, and hold your tea like a man, tuck in your pinky, you know, that sort of thing. It's a really terrific musical number. Consider this toast manly toast. And I really love the play, and I also really love, I mean, The Birdcage is a fine movie, but the French film, L'Cage aux Folles, is hilarious. It's top-notch in my books. And then, to add to my worst of list, I gotta say The Rock of Ages, the 80s jukebox musical movie. Talk about a flat, processed, nonsense musical, the clearly manufactured for the fans of Glee. There is no spirit in it whatsoever. Even Russell Crowe and Alec Baldwin can't save this mess, and that really says something. And now with that, it's time for the dumb joke of the week. A spider crawled into my keyboard, but don't worry, it's under control. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do so at The Back Row. You can reach TK by emailing tk@the-back-row.com. Be sure to peek behind the velvet rope for the steamy side of The Back Row. Robin can be reached by emailing robin.warder@the-back-row.com. Be sure to check out Robin's regular features, Robin's Underrated Gems and Before They Were Stars. And you can reach me by emailing gil@the-back-row.com. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next week. Thank you. Music for today's podcast comes to us courtesy of the Back Row's webmaster, Michael. You can contact Michael through the Back Row, the-back-row.com.